welcome to the Carrier's Edge podcast, episode 88. I'm Jane Jazrawi, co-founder of Carrier's Edge, and with me as always...
Mark Morrell, other co-founder of Carrier's Edge. And I got to say, that is the most energetic opening I've heard from you in ages.
Oh, really?
Yes, and you're sitting up straight and smiling.
Oh my God, that's what happens when you have a little bit of time off.
Well, we're going to talk about that today, yes. So.
Okay. Well, I also just got off the radio, so I had my radio voice on.
Yeah, I want to cash in on that energy and just sort of keep it rolling. So you were just doing a session on Education Station.
I was.
On Radio Nemo with Jimmy Mack. And so let's start by talking about that. So what were you guys talking about there?
Basically what I do when I go on the show is we talk about things that happened in the other shows that have been going on for the previous three or four shows. So what we were talking about, the importance of unlearning.
Unlearning.
Unlearning. Oh. And okay. So we were talking about what that is and how you do it. And then we were talking about asking questions, like people asking questions in class and the kinds of things that can happen and why it's important to ask questions and why not to be afraid of it. Things like that.
Well, tell us, what is unlearning? Is that like your unbirthday? It's all of the time when you're not learning something?
Kind of. I think you can kind of make that connection if you wanted to. Unlearning is, it's the act of basically breaking a habit. Mm. Now, I didn't say this on the show. I should have, but it is because your brain makes habits. And I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast about how your brain makes, you know, creates habits really easily because it's inherently lazy.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want to think about breathing, right? So your body does it. Your brain takes care of that.
Right.
Automatically. You don't want to think about anything that you do repetitively. Your brain wants to go, hey, I can make a habit out of that. And then I don't have to think about it. Less energy is used by me.
Yeah. It's an optimization trick.
Yeah. So the problem is that your brain doesn't decide whether habits are good or bad.
It doesn't care. It just wants the habit.
Yeah. It's neutral on that. So you can learn a lot of really bad habits, and experiences will give you bad habits as well, because you're going to respond to certain environments the same way every time. So if you go in the context of what we were talking about, of saying that going to, you know, starting with a new carrier or doing a new, you know, learning a new skill or doing all of that, you kind of have to start by unlearning. If you want to do it a different way, or if you want to do it, if you want to improve it, you often have to unlearn the bad habits that you picked up before. And Jimmy was talking about how, you know, it feels like you're going backwards, but you're not really. You're kind of just taking down the bad part of the building so that you can create something better.
Okay, so it's like the demolition at the beginning of a renovation.
Kind of, yeah.
You have to remove all the rot.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Also things that we didn't talk about on the show, but it was in that general vein.
So what prompted this? I know you said that you're looking at what had happened in previous episodes, and I know you guys kind of do a recap of the previous episodes. So had this come up from a previous guest?
Yeah, I think it was Boyle Transportation. Mike Lascaux from Boyle was on the show, and he was talking about, and they don't do ELDT or anything like that, but they do a lot of hazmat training.
Mm-hmm.
And because they, you know, they do a lot of hazmat. I think their work is either...
It's a lot of complex work. Yes.
And hazmat is there's part of a it. Lot of hazmat in there. And he was saying that, you know, if you think you can put someone in front of a video and for 30 minutes and they have them trained in hazmat, properly trained in hazmat, then you got another thing coming. Now, he didn't say it that way, but that's how it is in my head.
No, I did hear that part. And I think what he said, which was fabulous, is if a carrier is trying to give you a 30-minute video for hazmat, you should be scared.
That is a much more accurate version of what I just said.
And then from there, I guess he went into talking about how they spend time sort of making people unlearn all their bad habits.
Yeah, it's unlearning bad habits, which is really difficult to do because habits are there for a reason. And, you know, they're there so your brain doesn't have to spend energy on things. The best way to unlearn something is to actually just create a new pathway on top of it.
Mm.
So just replace the bad habit with a good habit. And that's a lot easier to do than just erase a bad habit.
Now, that's a really interesting idea that they spend time doing that as part of their onboarding for their drivers, because it occurs to me that a habit that might be good at one carrier might be kind of bad at another one, because there's going to be a lot of process-based stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And this is where you get into the whole thing of, you know, that's not how we used to do it, or we used to do it like this here, blah, 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 blah. You know, habit. Let me tell you why it's better doing it the way I'm used to doing it. It's that whole paper logs going to e-logs thing. Oh, paper logs were so much better because I was used to it.
Well, I'm also thinking about the way you do things with a particular set of equipment, running a particular lane, may be ideal for that and terrible with different equipment in different lanes.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're in the habit, if you spent 5 years at a company running this particular kind of equipment and this particular lane, and you go to this other company, you've got to unlearn all of that stuff.
And part of it is, and we were talking about it in terms of cleaning out a closet or basement or something like that. Part of it is kind of, you don't want to do it and you don't want to do it, but when you get into it, it's actually great. The problem is getting into is starting. Starting is the hardest part. But once you're in it and you start to see some results, or you start to see some changes, then it's, you wonder why you didn't, why you weren't doing it that way the whole time. But the thing is that you kind of have to forgive yourself a little bit, because there are reasons that you were doing it one way. And, you know, now you're doing it a different way. It doesn't mean that your original way was wrong. It's just different. It's how you progress. It's how you learn.
That's interesting. I think that makes perfect sense, that because your brain wants to get into a habit, it wants to build a habit, it does not want to remove that habit.
No.
That's a self-preservation thing. So it is not going to make it easy for you. It's going to fight you on that.
Yep.
It's going to be a challenge to break that.
And then that's why replacing is easier than new.
So when you say replacing, you just make it, you alter it? Is that how you do it?
Yeah. So for example, if you want to go on a diet and you want to lose weight and you want to do it through diet, then you're, instead of not eating, it's better to replace unhealthy foods with healthy foods.
Right.
So you're still eating. So your brain is satisfied to that. It's just, it's not getting sugar.
So you don't break that habit of eating at certain times. You just replace it with a new habit of eating different things.
Right.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be that. It can be, you know, instead of sitting on the couch or, you know, whatever you do after dinner, then, you know, replace it with the habit of go out for a walk.
That sounds crazy now.
I know. It's crazy. That's a bridge too far. But if you kind of reward yourself for doing that, then it's that whole creating a new habit can be challenging. But what you have to do is figure out, you know, why you're doing it, you know, and what is going to make your brain feel better about changing to whatever this new habit is.
Now, that's an interesting concept or discussion in the context of the kind of training that we do, which is a lot of theoretical stuff. And I think we spend a lot of time talking to people about how you can't just do the theoretical. You've got to pair that with a practical piece.
Right.
And so I think that practical element is probably a big part of changing those habits, actually doing it, doing the thing, practicing it. It's not just think differently about this or change how you think about logging or inspections. It's actually go out there and do it the new way and do it a few times the new way. I can see that being really valuable.
And have support doing it the new way.
Yes.
So you're not doing everything in isolation. So you learn it. So our theoretical content is really good for laying the groundwork. And we always say, do not do this by, you should never do online learning to, you know, on its own in a vacuum. It's crazy because it's not going to be very useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it in, so it's the knowledge base, and then you start with the practical, and then you have to have the support. You have to have follow-up, you have to have coaching, you have to do all of that, but you can't do coaching in a vacuum either, because that just feels like things are coming at you from nowhere.
Yeah.
So you have to have the theoretical knowledge so that you understand what is happening. Then you have to have the practical to have your brain learn how to do it and do it in real life. And then you have to have the feedback and follow up to make sure that you're confident in what you're doing. It's kind of like, you know, exercise, you can do the same thing. So you can theoretically read about why you should be exercising, because it's good for you, good for your heart, good for your muscles. It's going to, you know, keep you in the workforce longer, blah, blah, blah. But then you have to actually go and do it. Reading about exercise is not going to get you more fit. So you have to actually do it. But when you do it, it's really hard to do it without some feedback.
Yeah.
Like, and that feedback could be just you looking in the mirror. It could be joining a Facebook group. It could be, you know, if you're doing it at work, then some sort of celebratory or coaching as you go. And it's the same thing with any kind of learning. You have to have those three steps.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just sort of, you got me thinking about sort of the exercise thing, and it works best when you do some research and sort of learn about theory, which tells you what the form should be and what exercises to do for certain objectives. And then you go and do those things. But having a coach who can say, no, you're not quite getting the form here, or try this instead, or watch for this, things that you may not notice on your own, that's when you have the maximum success. And on the training side, absolutely, we see that happening. And the companies that are the most successful cover that theoretical part, then moving into a classroom discussion about that material, then going out in the yard and practicing it, having a coach or an instructor work with people on it, and then measuring the effectiveness of that, measuring it out in the road, and then cycling back in a couple of weeks and trying it again.
I think that's really what the MELT and ELDT in the States is all about, is it follows that principle, is that here's your theory, here's a whole bunch of practical activities, you're going to be getting feedback. But it shouldn't stop at the entry level. It should continue as people go through their careers. And I think, you know, anytime you're doing something new, even if it's just a new route or a new customer or a new, you know, a new system, you still have to follow that process. You can't skip one of those steps and think you're going to get the same result.
Yeah, well, that ties back to what we're seeing in the Best Fleets program, where people are changing up their onboarding quite a bit, and they're starting to have more of the pre-work, sort of that theoretical stuff done before you get there. But we're at a point where I think it was, I had this slide up 2 days ago, and it was 70% of participants, or 70% of finalists, have a post-orientation coaching program. So that's getting to the point where it's nearly standard practice.
Oh, no, it's nearly unscorable.
No, because they're doing it in different ways.
Okay.
So that and the check-in programs that come after orientation, 84% of people have those kind of check-in programs. 70% have coaching programs, coach slash mentor, that are formalized, that happen after the orientation is finished. And it really goes back to that, getting people to practice the things that you've told them and help build those new habits. It's really, I mean, you can't do it on your own. You can't do it just by saying, yep, I'm going to do this differently now.
But it's also, and this is what I was talking about on the show, is also from the trainer's point of view. Trainers get stuck in ruts too, and they tend to do the same thing over and over again, and you talk about things the same way. So what one of the things that Brad, how do you pronounce this? Do you know how to pronounce his last name?
Oh, okay. Just say Brad from Central Oregon.
Brad from Central Oregon. Brad, if you're listening, tell us how to pronounce your last name. It's spelled A-I-M-O-N-E. I can spell it.
Yeah.
It could be Amon, Imoni, I don't know. And I don't know why I've never actually asked him. But anyway, he was talking about, it's escaping me now. What were we talking about?
Instructors getting stuck in ruts.
Oh, he's talking about how he gets experienced drivers to come into orientation and not come in, like come in and watch the class and take notes and tell him what he could be improving and give him some thoughts.
So he gets experienced drivers to come and audit the class.
I think that's an awesome idea.
Wow. That's the first time I've heard of that in trucking.
Yeah. I was talking about it. And anytime you get new people coming in and, you know, like, and when we get people who come in, we ask them about what they think of their orientation. And sometimes we change it based on what they've said.
But even that's just new people. He's getting experienced people to come in. Now, this is something that happens on the corporate side pretty regularly when you're doing stand-up training. There's always somebody in there auditing that course, just watching it. And sometimes it's for their own benefit to learn the material. But other times it's a review and it's somebody assessing, you know, how the delivery is going and what parts are working, what parts aren't working, all of that stuff. So that's the first time I've heard of that happening in the trucking industry.
I thought it was a really, really good idea.
Well, that is something that now you got me thinking. You know, we are kind of watching that, and it's kind of a subconscious thing that I've been keeping an eye on and thinking about, that the maturity of driver training programs or train the trainer programs in the trucking industry. When we came in, there was no way for trainers to become really good. There wasn't a lot. There was the certified driver trainer from NATME and certified director of safety, and those are good programs. But if you are in a fleet, a mid-sized fleet, and you're trying to get a bunch more trainers up to speed, there really wasn't a lot of tools and support for that. And there really wasn't a lot of people doing it. So this is one of the things that's come with the prevalence of dash cams, is that everybody has got all of this footage that they want to coach drivers on. So they build this layer of road trainers or coaches that are all senior drivers and have those people work with the other drivers. And the challenge there is, how do you get those people, that layer of road trainers, up to speed and effective and continue to improve the program? And it's something that the industry is kind of dealing with now that it hadn't really dealt with at sort of an industry-wide level before. There was large fleets that had their own large training departments and were doing it internally, but at mid-sized fleets, it really wasn't happening because there was one trainer and that was it, or maybe two trainers.
Yeah.
So we're finally getting to the point where people have mature training programs enough that they need to manage that program overall. They need to manage the trainers, think about who's actually performing, who's not. How do I coach that trainer so that they can be better at what they're doing? How do I even measure the effectiveness of it? These are things that people are starting to think about. And so Brad's idea is a great one, is just have other people come in and watch it, have the trainers watch each other and get together as a group. We do see some fleets that have committees,
yes,
of their trainers, but it's an interesting change, sort of an evolution of the industry, that it's now at that point where fleets at a much smaller size need to start thinking about that, and some of them are.
Yeah, I think you've wrapped that up nicely.
I hadn't really thought about that before, but the industry has kind of hit a level of maturity there where it needs to start thinking about that.
And I think there are a lot more train-the-trainer programs out there, and especially at the schools. There mm-hmm. are more formal instructor training.
Yes, there is getting to be more of that.
It used to be that, you know, just throw someone with 30 years of experience in front of a room and, you know, have at it.
Yeah, but those are kind of like entry level. You're becoming a trainer. Here's how to be a trainer. And as we're talking about with drivers, it can't stop at that point. You've got to keep doing it. You've got to keep growing their skill set. And with instructors, it's the exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like with anybody.
Yeah.
You cannot just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and think that you're good, because things change. And actually, Brad was saying something about this when he was on the show, is that, you know, your program is going to change because it should be changing, because everything is changing. So if you're not moving at least the same pace as everybody, you know, as how the environment or how trucking is changing, then it's going to get stale. It's going to become, it's going to get less and less effective. And that's the same for a grade 3 teacher or a trucking instructor or, you know, anybody doing it. You cannot do it the same way over and over again, which I think I was cleaning out the basement.
Oh, I'm coming back to that.
Right.
Yeah,
but
I'm going to park that.
I was going through a lot of old training stuff, and it, you know, there's a lot of differences in what we used to do.
Yeah.
And how we do it now.
Well, you're giving me an idea for a new Best Fleets question. We've started on the Best Fleets questionnaire asking how fleets measure their fleet managers. This past year, we looked at how they measure their recruiting efforts, but we should be looking at how they measure their driver trainers.
And how do they incent? Like, how do they support and incent them?
That's one of the other things that I'm going to talk about on the second part of our webinar, about what are you incenting? Because that was sort of coming up as I was listening with you to some of these other radio segments, is people talking, I think it was that Boyle segment, people talking about doing one thing and then are they really doing it? Well, you know, and he's saying, well, safety has to come from the top and all that other stuff. And I was thinking, well, yeah, but it really comes down to what you incent. People will always respond to incentive. So if you say one thing but incent something else, you're going to get that thing that's incented. Doesn't matter what you say.
Doesn't matter what you say.
So that's one of the things I want to talk about.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about Boyle is because they do incent. The incentives are, well, they have a salary-based pay mm-hmm. model. And I think there's a lot of incentive. It's not incentive, it's like decentive. It's that you don't have to worry about certain things.
Right. Yeah, you're not incented to do the wrong thing inadvertently.
Yeah, you're not incented to do the wrong thing because you're trying to save time, because you're paid for your time.
Mm-hmm.
You're paid for getting the products from A to B safely and not fast.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more concerned about the process than they are about speed. And well, I think speed is important, but they're not concerned about having the problems all be the driver's problems. Rather, they're taking the problems to operations and to the rest of the company rather than having it sit on the driver. So that salary kind of acts as both an incentive and an incentive to not make the wrong choices, like you said.
It moves the problems into the areas where they really should be.
Right.
Rather than being on the back of the driver.
Right.
So,
as we have said multiple times.
Okay. So you touched on this already, and this was something that I was very eager to dig into. And as you're talking about this whole changing habits being like cleaning out the basement, I thought that was a very appropriate analogy, since you've spent the better part of the last week and a half
cleaning out the basement.
Well, it's not cleaner right now at this moment.
No.
It's differently organized and better organized. And we know which things are going into recycling, which things are being given away, and which, well, 5 bags of things have been shredded. But you have been very busy. And through that, you've had a lovely walk down
memory lane.
Walk down memory lane and walk down through the miles of history that are represented in all of our old files. And I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of you know, the things that you were reminded of the early days of e-learning, or the early projects in the online training world, and before it was even completely online, when it was computer-based and it was CD-ROM type stuff.
Oh God, the CD-ROMs. We had so many CD-ROMs because we were, okay, well, going back right to the beginning is I found HyperCard.
Wow.
Yeah. This happened actually when I was cleaning out my computer as well, because I did kind of the same thing to the basement as I did to my computer, because I moved to a new computer. And instead of just moving everything over, I decided to get rid of a whole lot of stuff that was very old. And while I was doing that, I was trying to get all my backups coordinated and put in the same place. And I found some HyperCard, and they used to be called HyperCard stacks.
Mm-hmm.
So HyperCard is an old software tool that basically let you put words and pictures together and kind of create a really, really like a PowerPoint deck, kind of.
Well, it was sort of a precursor to the web, because it allowed you to have these words and pictures, like you say, but they could hyperlink to each other. I think that was where that phrase came from.
Yeah.
The hyperlink was things that would move from one place to another and you could jump around.
Yeah. So now this was in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, it came in the early 80s. I think.
Okay, I discovered it doing a...
My old Mac Classic
had HyperCard.
Well, that was a late 80s machine. It had HyperCard on it. So yeah, it was a long time ago.
I was doing a computers in the classroom thing when I was a teacher. And so I learned HyperCard, and I thought it was so fabulous because I would eventually become, you know, an online training czar. So I didn't realize that at the time. But at the time, I was like, this is so cool that you could have these. It was basically like a set of index cards that you could put things on and then make them interactive. And there is actually a website which will run old HyperCard stacks, which is very cool. Yeah, I have to find it again. But in the basement, we had, you know, you have everything. So you had the offer letters from all your old jobs. Oh my God, you're terrible.
You never know when you might need that.
You never know where it might be entertaining. I found your hair.
Oh, yes. From when I was a musician, when I came off the road and got a real job, I thought I had to be respectable. And so I cut off my long hair. And kept it for some reason.
And then you grew it again. But I kept it because it's...
It's a very different color.
It is a very different color. Like, if you have to chop up your ponytail now, we'll have to compare it because it is not the same. But there was so many CD-ROMs. We had everything came on a CD.
Software came on it.
Oh, and it was like... Software companies were trying out any kind of thing to help you do everything. There is like all kinds of software programs on CD. I have turfed so many CDs of programs that lived for like 5 minutes.
Well, that was in the the late 90s, sort of the dot-com boom, but stuff was still distributed on CDs.
Yes.
Like, even though everybody was excited about the internet, not that much was actually happening on the internet at the time. It's kind of like what we've just come through now, where there's just this flood of people trying every idea imaginable, and most of them are terrible and are never going to succeed, but they try it anyway. The difference now is that you're not getting a CD-ROM, you know, in a magazine or in the mail or anything. It's just some website.
There were no AOL. We did not have any AOL.
Those I didn't think I needed to keep.
But there was a lot. We had our first email server for mm-hmm. the company, which was a first-class server, which is a defunct. It now belongs to OpenText, but it was a email and
collaboration.
Collaboration software, yeah, that we used because we had server licenses coming out of the yin yang. So we used that when we needed free things because we had no money in our business.
Well, you also found a lot of your old training material.
I did. I found one of the first tech companies I worked for, I did a leadership course and a teamwork course, and I found the binders for that. I found there was a company that I worked for that got purchased by a couple of other companies, ended up being part of PwC. It was called CMC, and it was, you know, how to do adult learning principles and how to create training content and that kind of thing. I found a bunch of...
Now, that was interesting. So stick with that one for a bit, because that...
Okay.
There was some of the material that I think you pulled out of that was like the very beginnings of e-learning, before it was even called e-learning.
It was... Yeah. Well, there was a whole whack of things called from a magazine called the E-Learning Guild.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I wrote a few columns for them.
And that was in the 90s, right?
That would have been early 2000s.
Yeah. Okay.
No, because we had, by the time I started writing for them, we had started this company, and that was kind of a marketing thing.
Oh, yeah. But the E-Learning Guild, yes, it was very fancy. And this is what the early theoretical stuff about e-learning was quite funny, because it was very formal and it was very wordy, and everybody had a lot of thoughts about e-learning and what you could do with it. And there was one article that I found, I don't know why I kept this, but it just talking about what e-learning was going to look like in the future. And what was really interesting is that it was very wordy and boring, but they kind of got it right, that it was going to be, it was the future, and people were going to be doing a lot of things on like that online learning. They didn't know what it was actually going to, like the internet wasn't quite there. They were talking about the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
That's how they talked about it. But they were talking about it being, you know, over the World Wide Web, and that this is how people were going to learn in the future, and, you know, why investing in it now is a good idea, and that kind of thing, and how it would work. And it was, they pretty much had it.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I think the E-Learning Guild is now.
I think it rebranded to the E-Learning Developers Journal.
Oh, yeah.
Then it moved into, I don't know if it's still around or if it's morphed into something else. But I remember it changing names when it became...
Probably part of ASDD.
Yeah, which is now ATD. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Now, when I was, the other thing that I found was I actually belonged to the Ontario Society for Training and Development. This was before we started the company, and I helped organize a conference.
That was a fantastic program. I was looking at that and was stunned by that program.
Yeah, it was. Well, the program was really, we had how many streams? Like we had 4 or 5 different streams.
1.5 or 2 day conference. And you had to have like 50 different sessions going on that thing.
Yeah, there was tons. And there was also a trade show.
Wow.
So there was, oh yeah. But one of the things that I did for that was I got one of the keynote speakers. And I don't know how I did this, but I think it was because I was into computers at the time.
Into computers. That was a thing.
Into quote unquote computers. And so therefore, you know, and nobody else was. I mean, this is OSTD in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Everybody was doing paper-based and consulting and that kind of stuff. I was the only one who was like, ooh, computers are really cool and learning on computers. So I ended up contacting, I don't know how I did this. I don't remember doing it. I remember it happening. I remember, anyway, I contacted someone from Silicon Graphics.
Mm. which at the time was a big name. They were a huge name in technology for graphics. Yeah.
Yes, they were. And they were kind of the beginnings of computer animation.
Oh, yeah.
Like that was really early days, way before Pixar. I think Pixar didn't use SGI machines because they were super expensive, or they did.
Eventually they'd use those or Sun. But yeah, they were.
I can't remember the history.
Yeah, very much the pioneer of computer graphics.
Oh, yeah. And this was like super cool for me because I am such a geek. And so I got the VP of something. I don't remember. I remember her, and I remember it was a woman. I was happy about that because even back then I was still like, you know, let's get women. Although training is pretty populated with women. She wasn't a trainer. She was more in like sales capacity, I think. So that was why she came and spoke. But I was so excited. Someone from, you know, Silicon Valley, SGI, this big company. And she came and talked about how, you know, information, you know, basically the future of computers and learning and stuff like that, which I thought was really exciting. But yeah, there was a lot of talk in that conference just about different projects that people were going through, and you know how they were working with different subject matter experts and things like that. There was a little bit about technology, and I was really excited about that.
Yeah, that reminds me of one of the things I always liked about those training conferences. Like you say, there was multiple things happening. And so at any given time, there would be five different sessions happening, which is crazy. If you go to even a large conference now in the trucking industry, you might have two. Most of the time, you don't have very much. It's just single stream and that's it. But part of the reason they were able to have so many is that they were much more specific. So it was, here's the problem I'm working through, and here was the challenge. Here's all of the things that we tried that worked and that didn't work. And then here's where we ended up. So they ended up being like these hour-long case studies of different projects. And it was so enlightening. And every time I went to a conference and went to one of those sessions, it was like, okay, I see how you solved this problem. And it's interesting to see what the challenge was and the different things that you tried. And you learn so much from all of those things they tried that didn't work that you can then apply on your own. And you get a lot out of it.
I think that's the difference between kind of us and a lot of people, because when we were kind of developing our in the early career development, that was the focus. How do we make this do this? Mm-hmm. How do we solve this problem? So it was always, how do we solve this problem? So I learned HyperCard. What am I going to do with it? And, you know, how do you make a HyperCard stack that is going to do this? There wasn't a program already there. How do you make, how do you use a computer to do X, Y, and Z? Like, how do you use a computer to create 3D animation? How do you use it to keep track of learners and what courses they've done and all of that? Because you were working on that. That was like, you went through how many LMSs? Have you been involved in building?
I think I've built 4 or 5 from the ground up.
And you also learned a lot about, what was SAP?
Oh, you found the manual for that, the Training and Events Manager, the first version of their LMS. Although I think at the time, they were so scattered and siloed. I think they actually had 2 or 3 different products that essentially did the same learning management function.
But I remember that your involvement in learning management was like started with SAP.
And Knowledge Warehouse.
Oh, that's right. That's what it was. I couldn't remember.
Which was basically an LMS, but they didn't call it that because nobody had that name yet. Nobody called it an LMS until Saba launched theirs and called it an LMS. And then the sort of category was created at that point. And then everybody scrambled.
Yeah, but before an LMS, that knowledge warehouse was basically, that was what people were always trying to do, is trying to store all the knowledge that was in people's heads. How do we get that out of people's heads and put it in some sort of system where you can just go and get.
How do you capture that institutional knowledge? That's always been a challenge. Which was the rebranded version after InfoDB.
Oh!
The most obvious basic name, an information database,
yes.
As if there's a database that isn't information. SAP is a great software product, very good with functionality and relied on by thousands of giant companies around the world, but they're not the most creative when it comes to the marketing and branding side.
But you know what? They had those they had the ideas, and when they didn't exist before, like, how do you get, I don't want to say database, I want another word for it, where, you know, how do you organize all of this information that you have in your company? Like, how do you do it? There was nothing before. So how do you go from nothing to, you know, what we have now, which is basically the internet is one big ass database.
And look at where we are now, where, how do people do that? They will have... just make videos of things. They will just film themselves talking it out or going and demonstrating something. And then that may get stuck on a YouTube page if it's not private, or it gets posted on an intranet or something like that.
But we couldn't do that because anything that you created with video was so big.
It had to be text. Somebody had to write it down.
You had to burn it on a CD.
Well, and even then.
And the CDs were not that big.
Yeah, and you couldn't hold that much, and it was low res, and it was expensive to do that.
So you had to come up with other ways. And so there was another program called RoboHelp, which I also found some documentation of a class that I had done on how to use RoboHelp for a group called Loyalty, which does air miles in Canada. And which, funnily enough, Charlie Charlambas, who works with the IHSA in Toronto, he was actually in one of my classes during when I did that.
The inevitably small world of the training
industry. Oh my
God,
so crazy, eh? But I was looking at that and looking at how I had to document things and all of the different... I had used this product so much, and what this product did was basically a screen capture.
Mm-hmm.
So you can record your screen no problem now. Like, you can basically, there's a software application that just basically says,
like, built into the OS in most
cases. You can just record what you do on a screen, and then you can use that for whatever. And if anybody knows Adobe Captivate, RoboHelp was the great, great, great granddaddy of Captivate. Is what Captivate ended up. And so when you had RoboHelp, you could create a screen capture, and then you could put captions on it so that you could also have clickable objects so that you can go from screen to screen and you can mimic.
Hang on, that was RoboDemo. RoboHelp was the tool that allowed you to create help files, which were things that people used to have.
Right.
And they would be tied to specific parts of a system. So you would build into your system a link to a particular RoboHelp file. It's essentially a wiki.
Yes.
Before they were ubiquitous, but it was an early way to do that. And it did include the screenshot and linking, easy ways to link back and forth. And it was used by everybody.
Oh, yeah.
For creating documentation, for creating help files. Before you had something like Confluence, before you had any kind of wiki tools, it was the way to
before
do it.
Before Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Remember the time before Wikipedia? And I thought Wikipedia was kind of a crazy idea. I thought it was kind of weird that, well, not weird, but I didn't think it was going to work, where everybody could just contribute to
this. And it didn't
this.
Work. So they clamped it down.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is that everybody was just contributing garbage, which is what I thought. And then, so now Wikipedia is kind of a little bit of a closed system. It was supposed to be for
it's
everybody.
It's still open, but it's a wider group. It's not completely open, but it has controls in place. It has editors and editorial groups that monitor different sections.
The other thing that I found when I was looking at the CMC stuff was adult learning principles. And there was about 2/3 of a page of bullet points, and that was it. We did not have it was not a 2-day workshop on adult learning principles, which I think having learned student learning principles and then later on learning adult learning principles, I really think there are just learning principles. There's just different motivations. And there's different ways, like, you obviously are not going to talk to an adult the same way you talk to a child, or you're not going to. And there are some things that children have to learn that they have no choice about. You're not doing that. Well, actually, no, that's not true. You do that with adults. You just have to handle it differently. So it's more of a behavioral difference rather than how people process information.
Mm-hmm.
It's so anyway, that's a whole other topic. But I saw that. There was that. Oh, I can't remember. What else was I going on about?
Oh, I remember you pulling out all of the CD-ROMs from the old...
Suncor
stuff, yeah. It was our first real major project in the company.
Well, we burned so many CDs for them.
I'm still kind of proud of how we made that work, because this was custom work and chain of gas stations. And back then, not everybody had a good high quality internet. This was early 2000s. So they needed internet and they had satellite internet, which gave them decent downstream speeds, but really no upstream. The upstream was still a dial-up modem, so it was super slow. So they really couldn't be running any kind of interactive content through the web. It was way too slow.
And also that satellite had to do all of the gasoline, like the whole...
It was their purchase system and all kinds of things.
Everything had to run on that satellite.
That one connection, yeah.
I don't know. They might not have anything better now.
No, they do now.
Oh, okay.
Well, because everybody's got cell networks and things like that. But we had to come up with a way to have content, interactive content, but also have all the results still stored in a central location, because they needed to track that all of those employees were completing all of their compliance training. Sounds familiar? Any tracking company? Same kind of thing. So we came up with, we built the interactive content and distributed it on CD-ROM and configured it so that at the end of the course, it actually would send an email with the results to a central location that would accept that email and put the data into a central system so that their head office staff could just have one single place they could go to. They could look up any site number and see the status of those people, and was the site up to date? Was it expired? Because all this stuff needed to be redone periodically. Was the stuff current? Was there anybody that wasn't staying up to date with it? It worked really well. It was great for their auditors. They could go and look at these things before they went and went to a site, and it was pretty hideous. When you look at it now, it looks disgusting. But at the time, it looked pretty good.
Hey, there is not a big difference between when things look disgusting and now. I mean, it's only you only have to go back 10 years and you're like, ew. I mean, things, I remember seeing, while I was cleaning out the basement, I remember seeing something about how to do Bevel and Emboss, how to do it, like how to, because it's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Bevel and Emboss, well, I think it was the closest thing to 3D that you could do without knowing very much about it without being very skilled.
Without having a silicone graphics computer.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So this is what you can do in PowerPoint or Word or your basic Photoshop, which I always enjoy telling everybody that, you know, I started using Photoshop if you wanted to add text to your picture, you'd better really want to do it because...
Couldn't change it after.
You couldn't change it. It was done. It was right in there.
Well, that was the early days of these things.
But going back to the Suncor thing, this is where we got really, really good, or I got really good at, everything has to be small. You can't have large audio files. We couldn't have MP3s for the longest time.
Yeah, well, there was licensing issues with the MP3 decoder. Yeah, so that was a challenge. Yes. Not everybody could do MP3, and we still had to have it running through a browser, so there was a lot of issues, and we were filling that CD-ROM with content, so we had to be very efficient.
Yeah, we had like 25 courses, something like that.
There was a lot of modules, and because it was deployed on CD, every time there was new stuff, we were shipping new CDs to everybody. So we got very good at burning CDs, sticking the labels on. We still have over there some of the old mailing envelopes for CDs, the square with the bubble wrap in them.
And we all burned CDs. Well, all. I mean, there was like four of us.
Yeah.
But burning CDs was the thing.
You create a little assembly line.
Yeah, and mailing them out. Like we didn't send it out. There wasn't anywhere to get anybody else to do it.
Well, you could. We just didn't have the money.
That's true.
So we did it ourselves, and shipped them in the mail, and we're dumping.
And they looked pretty good.
Yeah, for the time, they looked pretty good.
Actually,
and it
I
worked.
Think
got the job done.
Yeah, but they were the way that we design e-learning now is directly connected to what we learned from Suncor, how we solve that problem. Because we were, like I said before, everybody was always solving problems that had never been solved before.
Yeah.
And some of the issues that I see now with people who, you know, didn't go through that is that they don't have that experience and things are just the way they are.
They don't have the problem solving.
Yeah. And I think we got really good at, okay, there's a way to do this. How do we do it?
Well, that business of submitting the results at the end, nobody had done that. And that was one of the articles I wrote for the e-learning developers journal, was just taking it apart, what the challenge was and why any of the other established solutions at the time were not going to work, and how we came up with this and how it ended up working out. So even at the time, having a tool that would receive email and process it, that wasn't easy. nobody had that. It wasn't like now where you can just have some free service that will just accept email and parse it for you and turn the data into something. That didn't exist. So we had to figure out a solution for that. And it was one of those things where I'm kicking myself because I never patented
it.
It was one of the many things that I solved during those early days that I should have put a patent on. So,
Brett.
Well, the patent is kind of useless now because everybody's got something.
Yeah.
Some
solution. You might have been able to make some money on that.
Could have been a patent troll and sued all of those people. But yes, lots of things that you relive when you clean out your basement and change your habit.
Here's the thing that fascinated me as I was shredding things, and I was shredding because we kept everything from like 2000. Mm. So I have like, there was just receipts for everything and bills and like, you know, telecom and
hydro. You're
being
generous, but I know that was all me. I was the one who kept all of that stuff.
Well, I didn't get rid of it. But what was interesting is that how we've evolved in credit card numbers.
Oh, the privacy.
There is
wasn't really an issue then.
In 2003, if you bought something on a credit card, that credit card number and the expiry date were like emblazoned on the receipt.
Wow. Not masked. Like all the numbers, all 16 numbers.
No, that didn't start until like mid 2005 or 2006, I think. So I was like, you know what? I probably should shred everything that has a credit card number on it. I know.
That's hilarious.
Well, it was so bizarre because I was just sort of looking at it and going, oh, it's a, you know, credit card receipt. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. That's the whole number. And so then I'm looking at other ones. I'm like, oh, crap. That's the whole. Holy, everybody did the whole number. I can't believe that. I don't know when we started masking. I don't remember it, but I remember it happening. I remember something about masking.
Yeah. That's funny because now like even phone numbers are masked. Like, people don't even put those on a receipt a lot of the time. It'll be a masked number. Or like if they're checking, we're going to send a confirmation code to one of these three numbers. They're all masked. It's just the last two digits that you see.
And government documentation. Oh my God. Anytime there's a social security / social insurance number on something, which is, so what Revenue Canada does now is that they will use your social insurance number like on the top page. Mm-hmm. It only happens once. But in the past, they would have your SIN on every single page, whether that page was useful to you or not. Like it could
even if it was generic code,
just like nothing about except explaining something else, like something that isn't actually useful for your, what do you call it, when you send in your taxes?
Tax return.
Yeah, when your tax returns. It was just like, you know, junk. But yet I had to shred it because there it is. There's your SIN number at the top right of the page. And everything. So these are like 40 pages. I'm like, oh my God, I got to do. That's why we have such a lot of shredded paper in our basement right now.
Wow.
Because I was looking at every single piece of paper to make sure that the SIN number was not there. Or if it was there, then I was going to shred it because people put their SIN numbers on
Stop saying SIN number.
Okay.
The N is already the number.
Okay. Sorry.
Like PIN number. You don't have to say the number.
People were putting their social insurance / social security number on everything.
Yeah.
It was this piece of ID that was, you know, people didn't think that anybody was going to do anything with it.
Yeah.
Because you used to have to show the card.
Yeah.
You couldn't just.
Oh, yeah.
So that you had to show the card and then it went to, you just need the number. Then it went to, if you have the number, then you can somehow get people's bank account / mortgage information.
Yeah.
So
things have changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I think that is going to bring us to the end for today. We've had a lovely
walk down memory lane,
tour through history here, the early days of e-learning, and I've unlearned some things as well.
So, happy unbirthday.
Yes, thanks everybody for listening.
Have a good day.